This week, the U.S. Senate was up all night to talk about global warming. That option's not available for kids, especially on a school night. But that doesn't mean they don't have ideas to help slow down climate change.
Reuse materials until they cannot be used again. Buy less, adjust thermostat, two up in the summer, two down in the winter.
This week on the Allegheny Front, kids talk climate. Plus, will those same kids be able to ski or skate in Pennsylvania 50 years from now? That's all coming your way. Stay tuned to the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier, sitting in for Jennifer Shveta Jordan. This year on the Allegheny Front, we present Climate Chronicles. That's our series where we examine the causes and effects of climate change from a Pennsylvania perspective. We continue our climate coverage this week with a word from our senators.
But now, says the Onceler, now that you're here, the word of the Lorax seems perfectly clear. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not.
That was Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts. He was talking at this week's all-nighter in the U.S. Senate to raise awareness of climate change. Markey was reading, of course, from The Lorax by Dr. Seuss, the children's book about saving the environment from human impacts. In all, 31 U.S. senators took part in the all-night talkathon. At this point, talk about climate change is about all anyone expects out of Washington, D.C. anymore. But some kids in the Pittsburgh area may do the U.S. Senate one better. They're going to do something about cutting down on their own carbon footprints, even as their shoe sizes increase. The Allegheny Front's Justin Brown went to South Allegheny Elementary School in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, to hear their climate action plans.
What's your guys' team name?
The Green Dream Team.
Faith Allen, reduce, reuse, recycle, use less water, take shorter showers, buy things with less plastic, buy local, go outside, use reusable plates, use reusable cups, no styrofoam.
My favorite part is when we did the 1,000 Acts of Green, where every kid in the school pitched in and put an act of green in their classroom.
Kennedy Pakula, shut off lights when you're not using them, shop at local grocery stores, and influence others.
How do you influence others?
I just tell people what we've done so far and try to be more eco-friendly.
Zach Martin, recycle paper, use refillable bottles, no styrofoam.
You have no styrofoam written with like a bunch of exclamation marks. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, styrofoam never goes away. It kind of stays in the environment for a long time.
Carissa Solanders, reuse materials until they cannot be used again. Buy less, adjust thermostat, two up in the summer, two down in the winter.
So what was your favorite part of the project?
I liked how we were able to influence the younger kids about helping the environment more.
Maddie Kirkwood, buy one big bag of something instead of individual bags, ride with a friend to save gas.
Out of the entire list, what do you think is most important?
Take a reusable bag to the grocery store.
Do you bring any of your NPR tote bags?
No.
It's a nerd joke.
Those were students from McKeesport, Pennsylvania's South Allegheny Elementary. Their sustainability plan won a prize from Polar Bear International's Project Polar Bear. They took home first prize in the Cub category. Way to go, guys. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier, sitting in for Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Clean energy is seen as key to slowing down climate change, and solar power could be a key to this. One way solar panels can pay for themselves is through the process of net metering. That's a way of selling energy back to the grid from a solar panel that you've installed on your property. Pennsylvania is now proposing changes to its current system for net metering, and it has some solar advocates worried. They say it could make it harder for some people to harvest energy from the sun. All around the country, utilities and governments are trying to grapple with how to deal with this still small solar sector. Here to talk about this with us is Stephen Lacey. He's senior editor at Green Tech Media. Stephen, welcome to the Allegheny Front.
Hi, Reed. Thanks for having me.
So I was wondering if you could just set the solar industry in context for me. How big is it? How fast is it growing? And where does it fit in terms of the total renewable energy sector?
When you look at actual generation, solar still only represents about 1% of electricity generation in this country. But when you look at actual growth trends, it is expanding very, very quickly. So the industry put on about 4,700 megawatts of systems online in 2013. That might not mean a whole lot to people, but what it means is the industry in 1 year put the equivalent of about 5 nuclear power plants online.
Now, part of this boom in the solar industry is tied to net metering, I understand. Can you tell us what net metering is? I mean, most of us understand solar energy, the basics. You put the solar panel on your house. It feeds electricity to your house when the sun shines. But net metering is seen as key to this whole apparatus. Tell us about it and why it's so important.
Net metering allows an owner of a residential solar system to basically sell their electricity back into the grid for full retail electricity rates. And around the country, there are 43 states with these policies. The solar industry considers this to be the bedrock of solar policy and getting residential solar systems to actually participate in the energy market.
Now, Pennsylvania is one of those states that does allow for net metering. But recently, the state's Public Utility Commission, the PUC, has proposed some new rules on who can qualify for net metering. And some solar advocates are not happy about this. They say the state is putting roadblocks in front of solar. Can you explain what the state has in mind here, and how do other states do it?
It looks like Pennsylvania is really just trying to clarify who qualifies for net metering. There are two parts to this clarification. And the first is to just define who the customer is. They've said that a solar system to qualify for net metering has to be placed physically on the actual home to serve the electricity load. And they don't want solar customers with a big system that should probably get compensated for wholesale rates rather than retail rates to game the system. So I'll give you an example here. Say a homeowner wants to install a system and they have shading on their rooftop. Their rooftop is too small. They don't have a good space for it. Maybe they put that system on a ground mount in their backyard. The solar industry says that under these changes, that person might not actually qualify for the policy. The implications are that it could change who actually gets credited here. And the second piece of this is just a limitation on how much electricity you can feed back into the grid. What the PUC is saying is that the homeowner shouldn't get credited for more than 110% of the electricity that they're actually consuming on site in their home. And there've been a couple other caps that are similar. In Nevada, we've seen a cap of 150% of electricity consumption. And in Minnesota, it's lower at 125%. But this 110% is the lowest that I've seen. And I think the solar industry is worried that it puts solar at a disadvantage.
Yeah. So why would the state want to limit, you know, a homeowner's generation of solar power? It seems like, isn't that what we want? We want zero emissions electricity. What's going on here?
The utility industry sees solar as cutting into its business model. So when a person installs solar on that home and gets credited for it and the utility has to pay them for the electricity, then that's taking revenue away from the utility itself. And so that's why around the country, you're starting to see utilities attempt to change net metering laws, not necessarily to kill solar, but in their eyes, to make it more fair.
Now, with this surge in solar power across the country, there is a bit of a backlash. ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, a conservative and business interest group, has called people who use net metering free riders on the utility system and proposed charging solar panel owners to feed the grid. Why this opposition to solar, and what impact do you think it'll have on the industry?
Well, this is big for the industry right now. And the American Legislative Exchange Council is the political group that's running the opposition that you're seeing from some utilities. This is a group that brings together business interests with lawmakers, and basically they're just trying to get laws passed that are favorable to those businesses. And you've seen a couple big utilities support ALEC in their efforts to limit net metering. They call solar system owners free riders because the system owners are, in the utility's eyes, not paying for the full grid costs. The utility's forced to pay them for the electricity they produce, but the rest of the costs in maintaining all the complex machinery that makes up the grid isn't being accounted for. So this political front group is working with some utilities and attempting to rewrite legislation that changes net metering laws.
So does the utility industry and ALEC, by extension, do they have a point? I mean, if everybody buys a solar panel and puts it on their house, who is going to pay to transport all this electricity around the country?
I think they do have a point. And to some degree, I think the solar industry recognizes that they have a point. So if more and more people invest in solar and are using less grid services, the utility still needs to account for all the things, all the infrastructure needed to maintain the grid. And those costs are going to fewer and fewer customers. So long term, yeah, it's an issue. The problem is we haven't seen a definitive study that accounts for solar's value on the grid. And my sense is that what you'll see is that solar is a slight net benefit to the grid, but it's not as much as the solar advocates claim, and it's probably more than what the utilities claim. But we just haven't gotten there yet.
Well, Stephen Lacey, thank you for joining us today.
Reed, thanks for having me. A pleasure.
That was Stephen Lacey. He's senior editor at Green Tech Media. We were talking about new rules on solar energy in Pennsylvania and around the country. This is the Allegheny Front. Later in the show, ice skating enthusiasts all over North America are helping scientists map and track trends in outdoor rink use.
We were hoping that maybe by the end of the winter, we might have 50 or 100 rinks participating. We had that by the end of the first week.
Is it cold enough to skate or not? Listen for that story, plus how the ski industry will fare in the coming decades. That's when our show continues. Now a story about a natural gas drilling company, a fractivist, and one very big court order. A judge in northeastern Pennsylvania has signed off on an order barring an anti-fracking activist from setting foot on more than 300 square miles of Susquehanna County. It's all the land owned or leased by the area's biggest driller, Cabot Oil and Gas. As State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports, although the company asked for the court order, it says it didn't mean for it to be so broad.
If you Google the name Vera Scroggins, you'll get a lot of results, especially a lot of videos. She's a well-known anti-fracking activist who films many of her encounters. She also gives a lot of unofficial tours around Susquehanna County, showing visitors what gas drilling sites look like in one of the most productive parts of the Marcellus Shale.
Because I bring buses, minibuses, full buses, caravans of cars, single cars of individuals, and a lot of elected officials from New York.
Last year, Scroggins even hosted a celebrity tour, which included actress Susan Sarandon, Yoko Ono, and her son Sean Lennon, who has also been an outspoken critic of fracking.
Obviously, I've been researching fracking quite a bit in the last few months, but none of my research could have prepared me for how ugly this really has been today.
I mean, Scroggins doesn't fit the stereotype of a 63-year-old retired grandmother. Her activism against the gas industry has made her a polarizing figure, even among some environmental advocates. In another video posted by an energy industry-funded blog, Scroggins berates an Irish filmmaker who made a pro-gas documentary.
That's what you look like. So maybe I have to chase you. I'm going to chase you the f*** out of here, out of my country and county.
Do you not like immigrants?
Scroggins admits she's overreacted on some occasions. She knows she frequently irritates the county's biggest driller, Cabot Oil and Gas. But she says she was still surprised last fall when Cabot took her to court and got an injunction which prohibits her from being on any land the company owns or has leased. The key word here is leased. The court order goes beyond simply banning Scroggins from active work sites. It bars her from more than 300 square miles, or nearly 40% of the county, including places the company hasn't developed yet.
And looks like maybe Cabot didn't even realize how expansive it is, possibly, from what I'm hearing. But their attorneys put this together. And the judge signed it. What was he thinking?
Scroggins says the leased land includes many area businesses, everything from restaurants to grocery stores, even the brand new Endless Mountain Hospital.
This whole thing, 10.7 acres, I looked it up, it's leased to Cabot.
John Dernbach is the co-director of Widener University's Environmental Law Center. He says he's never heard of a case like this and points out that much of what Scroggins does is free speech protected under the First Amendment.
If Cabot doesn't have the legal right to exclude her from the surface based on whatever lease arrangements they have or whatever other legal arrangements they have, then the order is way too broad. It's one thing to keep her off work sites and places where drilling is actively going on. It's quite another to keep her from everything else.
Company spokesman George Stark says Cabot didn't intend for the court order to be so expansive. He didn't want to go on tape, but emailed a statement which reads in part, Cabot supports an individual's right to express his or her opinion. Ms. Scroggins has repeatedly trespassed on company operational sites and access roads where she could potentially jeopardize the safety of herself and others. Public facilities such as schools, grocery stores, recycling centers, or hospitals are obviously not operational areas. But Scroggins says she's never been convicted of trespassing and doesn't feel that she should be singled out.
I feel like a prisoner. I feel like they might as well put some kind of a bracelet on my ankle to keep track of me.
Meanwhile, some landowners, like Jerry Gear, who have leases with the company, argue it shouldn't dictate who can and can't be on their property.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Vera is, she gets in their face. She's aggressive. And, you know, I can understand where she could definitely annoy people. But on the other hand, it seems like it's a situation where we've got this little lady in tennis shoes, and the huge oil company is running scared. You know, if they don't have anything to hide, why are they putting up such a fight?
Scroggins has asked the judge to vacate the order. The two sides are trying to negotiate an agreement about where she can and can't go. They're due back in court later this month. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
State Impact, Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.
This is the last official weekend of winter, and if you like ice and snow, it's been a really good year for you. As part of our Climate Chronicles series, we have a pair of reports on the disappearing joys of winter sports. First, skating. Backyard ice rinks have long been a part of winters in Canada and the northern U.S., but that could be changing. Scientists are now asking people with these outdoor rinks to help them out with some citizen science. They want to ask them one simple question. Were you able to skate today? As the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsoppel reports, it could help them see how their climate is changing and whether there's a future for outdoor skating.
After school one day in February, Mike Gordon escorts his daughters, Rebecca and Dora, onto an ice rink that's a little unusual. It's in the front yard of their Pittsburgh home.
I think the middle is going to be better, guys, because there's some snow on the outside around the edges.
Sometimes cars stop on their busy street just to check it out. One reason the Gordons bought this house was because it had a nice flat front yard, perfect for a DIY ice rink. When I visited, 8-year-old Dora in pink earmuffs said she likes that she could come out and skate whenever she wants.
How long can you stay out here before you have to go back inside?
I don't know, until I'm freezing.
The surface of the 20 by 40 feet rink is kind of crunchy and uneven today, since it's been sleeting. Gordon levels some rough patches for the girls by scraping it with a hockey stick.
The best conditions are when it's really, really cold and really clear and not a lot of precipitation, because then it just freezes and it has that sort of glass, you know, glass smoothness to it, and that's when you have really the best skating.
The wood frame goes up around Thanksgiving, and when the weather gets cold enough, Gordon fills the plastic-lined rectangle with water from a garden hose. The family and their neighbors skate and play hockey here mid-December into February or March.
The way I figure it around here is if we get 10 skates in during winter, I'm very happy.
Last year, they only got 2 or 3 skates in. The year before that, none at all. That's exactly the kind of information that a team of Ontario-based scientists is looking for. Last winter, they launched RinkWatch, an online crowdsourced map of ice skating rinks all over North America.
We were hoping that maybe by the end of the winter, we might have 50 or 100 rinks participating. We had that by the end of the first week.
Robert McClemon of RinkWatch says 1,000 rinks were logged by the end of last winter, a quarter of those in the U.S. RinkWatch asks users to register their rinks by location, no personal information required. The only other thing they want to know is if it's skatable. The more often RinkWatchers answer that question, the better. RinkWatch is testing the theory that global warming is going to make it more difficult to have an outdoor rink. And they hope to start a conversation about how climate change may change our everyday lives. McClemon says the media tends to focus on threatened polar bears or Arctic ice disappearing.
Those examples don't really resonate with your average household here in North America who aren't going to encounter polar bears in their lifetime.
He says if the climate dampens our ability to skate outdoors, it might help make that connection. RinkWatch is trying to get more people involved by word of mouth and social media. McClemon says they'll need a lot of data over many years to tell a larger story about climate change, and not just about weather variability year to year. For now, they're posting results back to the website so users can see how their data is contributing to science. And they've created a forum so users can share their ice conditions, rink-building expertise, and skating stories.
Older generations are saying, well, when we were young, we would build a rink and we could skate on it from, you know, the end of November right through till Easter. And you just can't do that today.
McClemon says it's begun a dialogue between generations about the quality of the outdoor environment. Back in Pittsburgh, as Mike Gordon watches his daughters and the neighborhood kids skate around his rink, he says he feels that tug of the past. His dad, a youth hockey league pioneer in Pittsburgh, started the ice rink tradition in his family.
I really do believe it was something he gave to us that was a gift that I want to pass on to my kids, and I hope that it kind of continues through the generations. I know that sounds a little sentimental or whatever, but it's true. It really is.
Climate forecasts predict wetter, warmer winters for Pennsylvania, but Gordon hopes there will be many more skatable days like this in the future. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsoppel.
From skating to skiing now. In Pennsylvania, the downhill skiing industry is worth about $360 million in annual economic impact. But climate scientists predict that half of the resorts in Pennsylvania could be forced to close in the coming decades. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that the models also show that if greenhouse gas emissions are curbed, some of those slopes could live on.
It's a little rainy, despite the cold wind blowing at the Blue Knob Mountain Resort in Claysburg, east of Johnstown. Rocky Sproul is right at home. He grew up skiing Blue Knob and still lives just over the ridge.
Actually, my dad worked here, ran the ski school desk for years.
Really?
Yeah. So
now Sproul is a retired school teacher and a part-time ski instructor. His bright red cheeks and friendly smile make him a favorite at Blue Knob. He jumps off the ski lift, ending his lesson with a young girl, and heads out to the expert trails to enjoy the view, the quiet, and a vertical drop he says will curl your hair.
Can you see the valley floor? Yeah, and it's straight pitch from here to there. It's all soft bumps right now. You can see how soft the snow is.
It's midweek and the slopes look sparse. There aren't many skiers or lines at the lifts. The early season around Christmas time started slow at Blue Knob and elsewhere in the region, but Sproul says cold and snow the rest of the winter have actually made for a good ski season at Blue Knob.
This has been a great winter, all in all, for Western Pennsylvania.
That hasn't been the case in many recent years, particularly the winter of 2011-12, one of the warmest on records. Kids were in t-shirts, not thinking about ski slopes. Blue Knob owner Rich Gauthier says they lost more than $150,000 that season. Some bigger resorts lost much more, in the millions. Gauthier says winters like that are one reason he spent more than $1 million on snowmaking equipment.
Everybody has to make snow nowadays. Even out west in the Rockies, they're making snow at the lower level. you can't count on Mother Nature to do it for you.
But Mother Nature doesn't always allow humans to work around her either. Snow, natural or man-made, doesn't hold if temperatures aren't low enough. It's got to stay below freezing at night to maintain the cover.
Yeah, no. Well, that's the bottom line for our model.
Daniel Scott is director of the Interdisciplinary Center on Climate Change at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. His team has published predictions for the ski industry based on what's happened in past warm winters.
Whenever we've talked to the ski industry, they tell us, don't tell me how much snow is going to fall. I don't care. Tell me how cold it's going to be and can I make enough snow? And that's what our model does.
To be considered economically viable, a ski resort has to be open at least 100 days per season. That means it needs to be below freezing temperatures long enough to maintain snow cover for 100 days. Scott's team modeled climate predictions separately for eastern and western Pennsylvania, and they looked at different scenarios, if greenhouse gas emissions were at low levels or at high levels. Across the state and at both emission scenarios, they predict a loss of 15 to 20% of the ski season over the next couple of decades. Scott says that's not too bad.
By mid-century, I would think most of your ski areas with advanced snowmaking would still have a good chance of being in operation.
Scott says some states, such as Connecticut, will lose all of their ski resorts, while Vermont will likely maintain all of its skiing. But Pennsylvania is right on the bubble of that 100-day season. He says a key factor will be getting cold weather early enough. Many ski resorts depend on being open for Christmas and New Year's, but they need cold enough temperatures for the snow to stick. This year in Pennsylvania, it rained during that holiday week, but otherwise it's been a cold, dry winter, and that's kept the slopes in good shape. But if greenhouse gas emissions continue at higher levels, Scott doesn't think PA ski resorts will make it past the year 2070.
Later century, particularly under the warmer scenarios, now you're looking at a 50% loss in your ski season, so that's no longer sustainable at that level.
The Union of Concerned Scientists says under similar models, the closest major ski resort to Philadelphia would be nearly 300 miles. Pittsburghers would have to drive 500 miles to go skiing. At Blue Knob, which is just a couple of hours from Pittsburgh, owner Rich Gauthier doesn't give long-term predictions like this much credence.
It's kind of like the weather people. You know, how nice is it to be able to get paid and be wrong? I mean, that probably drives me crazy more than anything. I always say that if you want the weather, if you don't like the weather on one report, just turn to another one because you'll get a different and you keep going until you find the one you like.
Researcher Daniel Scott doesn't dispute these kinds of comments.
They're exactly right. You know, it's variable year to year. That's what weather brings. And what we would expect is just we would get more of those warm years over time. And so by the 2050s, what we're considering to be a record warm year now would actually be sort of a fairly average winter then.
Scott says the problem for many resort businesses is that they can't sustain the lost revenue of even two warm winters in a row. But Scott's climate models and others that look at Pennsylvania show that things don't have to go downhill for the state's ski industry. If the amount of greenhouse gases is reduced, they predict many more ski resorts could remain viable. Knowing that has politicized an industry known for its laid-back style. In recent years, skiing trade groups have been lobbying in Washington on various climate and energy bills. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kara Holsoppel is the production and digital editor. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Reed Frazier, sitting in for Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments. Our coverage of the Marcellus Shale is supported by the Roy A. Hunt Foundation, the Park Foundation, and the George and Miriam Martin Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation. The Pittsburgh Foundation supports Climate Chronicles, our series on climate change.